For me, Cecil is the model of someone who knows deeply what is right and what the true foundation of his church is. Maybe he understands fear or prejudice. Maybe he even feels some of it himself, but he doesn't let that get in the way or sway him from what's more deeply important. He keeps his eyes on the prize. He stays focused on what I would call the soul or the sacred identity of his church. For him, the Bible and the life of Jesus keeps him reminded of the church's soul or sacred identity. How does the church lose its soul? In that story of Cecil's congregation, people were initially moved by their personal fears and prejudices before Cecil called them back to their best selves. But what if Cecil hadn't been there or said what he said? A congregation can go badly astray, not only through fear and prejudice, but by misunderstanding, by petty disagreements, greed or power struggles, or simply avoiding conflict and discomfort, and they lose their souls. In Cecil's words, they lose their relationship with God. We live in an era when large numbers of Christians and their churches have lost their souls. Look at today's climate of religious bigotry and Christian nationalism. In a recent issue of the Christian Century newsletter, the Reverend John Pavlovitz wrote that it seems that many of the loudest people are the ones who have most passionately embraced a theology of cruelty, exclusion, and malice, one that bears no resemblance to Jesus. Instead of being known for empathy and love for diverse humanity, many self-identified Christians, he writes, are obstacles to bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice. And let's not be smug. We Unitarian Universalists have not been immune from those kinds of sin. I would remind you of Unitarians back in New England in the 1840s, or 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Wealthy Boston Brahmins, many of them, huge financial supporters of Unitarian churches in eastern Massachusetts, many of them owners of textile factories whose income flowed from cheap cotton picked by enslaved human beings. Monetary greed could indeed powerfully seduce some of our ancestors from what they claimed to believe about equality, what they claimed to value. Now, for Unitarian Universalists, it's mostly not the Bible. So what is it that keeps us in touch with the deepest meanings of our lives, our sacred identities? How do we as individuals and as congregations avoid getting sidetracked by fear or petty concerns that are unworthy of our deeper loyalty? How do we keep our UU churches focused on what is most truly and deeply important? A religious congregation like this one, or any other UU church, or any church of any denomination for that matter, exists to be and to do something. And most of our UU churches express that purpose in a mission statement, words that remind us of what we're all about, what we intended to do when we were first organized, and why it is that we continue to commit our time and our treasure and our loyalty to the congregation's ongoing well-being. You all know about mission statements. Your church has one. I looked it up. It's right there on the website. It's a statement that invites relationship to one another, growth in spirituality, and then looks outward to the world, to the work of the world. Its purpose is to remind you what your congregation is about. We don't belong to UU churches, after all, to boost our own egos or to go on power trips or to act selfishly against the good of the whole. The church has a purpose, a mission. It lifts up our eyes to a higher vision, one that digs deeper into the meaning of our lives. Those are soul matters, matters of sacred meaning and identity. And it's the same with our nation, I believe. Depending on what date you start counting from, this might be either the 249th or the 250th year of our nation. If we count from 1776, then we remember those soaring phrases from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. And later on, when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is a right of the people to alter or abolish it. Or if we count from a year earlier, in 1775, in April, we might recall that bit of poetry from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who, remembering the skirmish at Lexington and Concord, wrote, "By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flags to April breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world." We would do well to remember, I think, in our own troubled times of today, just what it was that got those embattled farmers so riled up. According to Thomas Jefferson, their souls were troubled by, quote, "a long train of abuses and usurpations" that he detailed in the middle section of our Declaration of Independence. It's not a part of the Declaration of Independence that we read very often. So let me remind you of just a few of those allegations that those embattled farmers raised against King George III of England. "He has obstructed laws for naturalization of foreigners and refused to pass others to encourage their migrations hither. He has made judges dependent on his will alone. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has cut off our trade with all parts of the world. He has deprived of us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. He has transported us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses." Wait, was that then or now? And after going on with that list, Thomas Jefferson closed the Declaration with these words, "For the support of this Declaration, with firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." We know that many people on both the political right and left look up to and honor our American ideals with sacred reverence, however differently they may see them in practice. For many of us, words like that from the Declaration of Independence embody the soul of America. And especially since last summer, during the electoral season, we heard a lot about saving the soul of America. Twice in his farewell address, Joe Biden spoke of the soul of the nation and of the torch atop the Statue of Liberty. We as a religious movement have our own torch, our chalice, our flame. In that way, the analogy between church and nation is symbolized again in the warmth and the image of a flame, either lifted high or cupped in the protective embrace of a chalice. But talk of America's soul is not a new thing. Back in the 1920s, the British, or in the 1910s, I guess, right after World War I, the British essayist and social critic G.K. Chesterton made a trip to America, traveled around for a couple of years, and when he got back, he published a book called What I Saw in America, and he wrote, among other things, "America is the only nation in the world that is founded on a creed. That creed is set forth with dogmatic and even theological lucidity in the Declaration of Independence. Perhaps the only piece of practical politics that is also great literature." And he went on a few sentences later to emphasize the point when he wrote that the United States is a nation with the soul of a church. This way of thinking about our national identity suggests there are some important similarities between protecting or saving the soul of a church and protecting and saving the soul of a nation. Just as with a church, we as a nation need ways to remind ourselves of what the American experience is all about. If churches do that through their mission statements, then I would say that our nation also needs a mission statement to keep it from losing its soul. So what is our national mission statement? When I was first working on this sermon, I asked my wife if she knew what America's mission statement was. Her first suggestion was to boldly go where no one has gone before. Well, there actually might be some truth in that, because we were the first of all the settler colonists to rebel against European rule. And we were also the first nation ever to have a written constitution. When the Articles of Confederation proved to be unworkable, a group of founding fathers, as we called them, in 1787 gathered in Philadelphia to write a new constitution, the one that we now know. They holed themselves up for 4 months, and when they came out, they have the constitution as in the first form that we knew it. And the legend is that as Ben Franklin came out of the doors and started down the steps, there was a woman who called out to him, said, "Well, Mr. Franklin, what kind of government have you given us?" And Ben reportedly replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." A lot of us fear that we have not kept it, or if we have, it's hanging by a thread these days. In these times, we find ourselves in kind of a midlife national crisis. We learn again and again how fragile democracy is, how fragile civilization itself is, and the social and civil life that gives us the nation that we are familiar with. And yet I think our country does have a mission statement. It's right there in the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. I bet some of you can probably say it along with me. "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." That's a list of six great visionary principles: unity, justice, peace, security, well-being, freedom. But as we all too well see, mission statements are lists of values in churches and in nations, are useless if we don't honor them. Checks and balances, as our nation's founders knew, are useless unless they operate under some commitment to the common good. They require leaders who live and govern with honesty and integrity and respect for others, those same virtues that were lifted up in that story for the children that I told earlier, integrity and honesty. What if we truly made use of those phrases from our preamble? What if every piece of legislation, every judicial decision, every administrative rule and regulation were to be judged against the words of that preamble? Compare that with what we have now, a capitalist value system that seeps into nearly every aspect of our lives, replacing kindness with corruption, moral integrity with greed, concern for the common good in place of an ideology with unregulated power for the wealthy. What is happening at the highest levels of our federal government strikes at the very root of our democratic process, at the depths of the American soul. So how do we save our souls as individuals, as a religious congregation, as a nation? I look to this flame and think of all the ideals that it stands for. Is it too sappy to think that a politics of love could be our salvation? I think of Cecil reminding his little congregation that love of neighbor is what is fundamental. And I also think of the actions of our General Assembly at UUA a little over a year ago, when UU congregations voted to declare that love is at the center of all that we do. We are indeed living in dark times. But the sick activist, that's sick, S-I-K-H, sick activist, Valerie Carr, asks us to look beyond the present moment and push forward with what she calls revolutionary love. What if our present moment can give birth to a new era of revolution? What if our present darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? And she is very explicit in her birthing language here. She says what is required of us is an alternation between breathing and pushing. Breathe, push, breathe, push. It's an interior and exterior work that is required of us to be communities that will make a difference. We are making a difference in some small ways. Some lawsuits are moving through the courts, and there are a lot of backstepping by the courts, but some are moving forward. Our Unitarian Universalist Association in February joined with 28 other national religious bodies to bring suit against multiple government agencies for intimidating people in their exercise of religious freedom. Some of my colleagues in the Washington, D.C. area, many of whom are government employees, are staying away from UU churches lest guilt by association result in their losing their jobs. But how long, I would ask, will it take before millions of working people who cast their votes for Donald Trump will realize, as David Brooks wrote a few months ago in his New York Times column, that their supposed hero, quote, doesn't give a crap about the working class? It's happening already, as you know. 3 months ago, I was marching with thousands of people in downtown Oakland on No King's Day, while Donald Trump was busy exposing himself on Pennsylvania Avenue in a military parade. A month later, I was in San Francisco's Pride Parade, shouting down the homophobia and transphobia that our federal, that pollutes our federal administration. How long will it take before masses of people, including many of us, I hope, both as victims and allies, are going to be out on the streets, not by the thousands, but by the millions, protesting against the lies and the cruelty and the monstrosity of the bill that was signed into law on July 4th. And I can't leave this recollection of local protests in San Francisco and Oakland without taking note of what happened in Israel just last weekend, a week ago. Maybe some of you read about this. Nearly 1 million people were out on the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities around Israel demanding an end to the ghastly war that Netanyahu is perpetrating against Gaza. 1 million. Now, in a country of 9 million people such as Israel, that's 10% of the population. What if 10% of Americans were out on the street? That would be a population of 35 million, nearly the entire population of California. What would it mean for that people in those numbers to be out on the streets of our nation? Justice, says Cornel West, is what love looks like in public. And our call is to make that transformation of love into justice visible, powerful, and irresistible. Like Cecil, we need to keep our eyes on the prize and not be distracted by fear of our own physical safety or moral numbness. Our challenge is to become communities of protest, communities of resistance, communities of action, communities that rise up and say, we're mad as hell and we're not gonna take it anymore. And to do that, we need solidarity. We need massive protests. We need inspiration to conquer our apathy, to keep ourselves focused, uplifted, renewed, and fully determined. Sometimes I think that it is the poets who will save us, who will, with the power and the eloquence of their words, call us to renewed vision and action, call us out of fear and comfort into discomfort of placing our minds and hearts and bodies on the line for what must be done to save our nation's soul. That's what Walt Whitman did. It's what Harlem Renaissance poet Langston Hughes did. It's what Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Maya Angelou and Audre Lorde and bell hooks and so many more did. And so in the spirit of those prophetic poets, I close with words that some of you may recognize, words spoken by that brave young woman and poet, 22 years old, Amanda Gorman, at Joe Biden's inauguration back in 2021. Here's the ending of her poem. We will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the wind-swept Northeast, where our forefathers first realized a revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover, and every known nook of our nation, every corner of our country, our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge, battered and beautiful. When the day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. And I say, amen. May it ever be so.